From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is summer, time to grab a towel, some sunscreen, and a book. The Great American Read has a list of 100 of the nation's favorite books ripe for the cracking. The PBS series crosses the country this summer to talk with people about the novels that they love and why. And you are invited to join in and vote for your favorite. It's kind of like American Idol for books, except there are 100 competitors and just one winner. And there are a number of ways to get in on this national contest, including a quiz that reveals which fictional character you would be. I am Michael Corleone from The Godfather by Mario Puzo, number 42 on the list, by the way. We're going to leave those similarities behind and turn instead to Allison Law, host of the Literary Atlanta podcast. Hello, Allison.
Hey, good morning, Virginia.
Great to have you here. And Nikki Salcedo, a Decatur-based author, is also with us. Hi, Nikki.
Good morning.
So did you take the quiz?
Yes.
Okay. Who's going to fess up?
Nikki, you go first.
I'm Tom Sawyer. And I felt that was completely accurate. So I thought the quiz was valid.
Now I understand why you wanted me to whitewash that fence.
Yes.
How about you, Allison?
I am Atticus Finch.
Oh, well. Who wouldn't want to be Atticus Finch?
No, I know. It's very appropriate.
So, all right. So this is, you know, of course, a fun way to get into this contest. But what does that say about you? What about the books that you read? Do you ever judge people from the books that they read?
I never do. I judge people for having a book. And I love that, you know, now there are different ways for people to read. They have it on their phones. They have it, you know, in secret places in their pocket. Any way people can read is a good way.
And we've posted a link to take the quiz yourself at gpbnews.org. All of the choices on this list of 100 are fiction, so they're novels. Do you tend to read fiction or nonfiction, and why, Allison?
I read both. And I think it's really cute when people post, I'm currently reading this book, because I usually have 6 or 7 books open at a time, and I'm reading bits of each at a time because I need the fiction to kind of shut down my brain. I need to escape and get into a good fictional story at the end of the night. But then nonfiction, I'm all about going back to class and taking notes and absorbing information.
Nikki, the writer Deborah Eisenberg said, fiction is a report from the interior.
Absolutely. I predominantly read fiction. I like to get away from the real world, and fiction is that beautiful gift of feeling like you've lived on a prairie in outer space, or you're a mobster.
For example.
Exactly.
Well, let's look at how the books were chosen. There were about 7,200 people participated. They voted, and then it was narrowed down by an advisory panel of 13 literary industry professionals. So first of all, how do you think they did with the list, Nikki?
I thought they did a great job. Any book that has Left Behind and 50 Shades of Grey really encompasses what Americans read. And it's much more accessible than previous lists of a similar nature.
What do you think, Allison? How'd they do?
I totally agree, because I love that they have some classics, the things that we grew up studying in school, and then they have some very popular fiction that's just come around in the last, you know, Jason Reynolds' book is from 2016, Ghost.
Right. Jason Reynolds is somebody that we spoke to on this program, and we'll be hearing from him just a little bit later on his picks. But, you know, any big surprises here?
Hmm.
I mean, 1984, number one. A lot of people read that in high school.
Right.
Confederacy of Dunces. Some great, as you said, classics. A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. These are books that so many Americans have read, but wondered if there are any. You mentioned 50 Shades of Grey, Nikki.
Well, I think no surprises. Maybe I was surprised on the book they chose for an author, but all of the authors who I really like were represented. And then I would see a book and say, well, I would have picked the other book this person wrote. But no book on the list that I thought should not be on the list.
Well, predominant, about a quarter of the books were in the science fiction fantasy genre.
Yay!
which
I
you
know,
both
I was
applaud.
Like, Nikki, that is right in her sweet spot.
Including on number 3, George R.R. Martin's best-selling Game of Thrones series. Now, this has been for a thrilling fantasy television hit on HBO. This is George Martin on the influence of The Lord of the Rings on his Westeros kingdom.
College kids of my generation would put up posters in their dorm rooms, but they would be a map of Middle-earth, not a picture of any of the characters. It was the world of Middle-earth was as important as any of the characters. And Tolkien really established that, and I think later writers of epic fantasy like me have followed in his footsteps.
So super popular book, super popular series. How about looking at this list, any should have been a contenders?
Oh, goodness. There are too many that I could have added to the list. I was surprised that John Grisham didn't make it to the list. In talking about, you know, people who are very popular, I would love to see Jesmond Ward appear on the list. So, you know, there's going to be, as literature continues to evolve and we have new voices come into the canon, then I think you're going to have a new list.
Here's somebody who would agree with you, Jason Reynolds. Again, he's the author of the best-selling YA track series and Ghost. He was at Eddie's Attic earlier this month. Here's what he said to say when asked about what he would choose or add to the Great American Reads list.
If I had to pick one off the top of my head, I probably would go, I'm going to lean contemporary because I try to make sure that we continue to Let's continue to move forward, all right? I would probably go with, and it's not on the list, actually. It should be on the list. Great American Read people, should be on the list. Jesmond Ward, Salvage the Bones.
Well, there you go. How about you, Nikki? Any should have been a contenders on this list?
I thought maybe Kindred from Octavia Butler. That's another sci-fi. There are a couple of books, but I'm okay with them not being on because they still have their space in the literary community.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, people are passionate about books, right? You know, we love our favorite books. And so many of these things on the Great American Read, they are popular books. They were bestsellers. Is there only one way for a book to be great? Is it the writing? Is it the popularity? Or even the timeliness or the timelessness?
For me, a great book is a book you want to read again. And that could be timeless. It could be timely. Anytime I see anyone reading a book, I'm so excited. I'm so excited to have this list because when I saw this list, I said, oh, I have work to do. I have more books to read that I haven't read yet.
How about for you, Allison?
Well, I like that I can read a book once. One of my favorite books on this list is The Joyla Club by Amy Tan. And I picked it up yesterday off my shelf and read the first page and was in tears because I hadn't read it since I was 25 years old. But this is a story of four Chinese mothers and their American-born daughters. And the very first page is a fable about what it's like to be an immigrant mother and the hope that you have for your family in another country. So I like how the book can have different meanings for you each time you pick it up.
There's also a number of banned books on the list. J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, Toni Morrison's Beloved, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, all have been regulars on lists of banned books. So these are books that have been around for a long time. How about what Jason said? Would you go contemporary? Would you push it beyond those that are considered classics?
I think you do push it, but I think you have to have To Kill a Mockingbird, because that is, you know, a story that came out in 1960, and you also have to have Gone with the Wind so that you can look and see what was happening at that point in time and then compare it to what's happening when you're reading it and be able to analyze it critically and say, this is right, and this is something I don't agree with.
How about for you, Nikki?
I definitely agree. And thinking back on a book I might have added or a series, I was thinking about The Little House on the Prairie, which has come into new controversy. Mm-hmm. Fiction is also history. And I think we should be careful that we understand the context and appreciate the history of things, even if it has changed. And so I like the idea of a mix of classic and then adding contemporary voices as well.
So a lot of these books also, The Catcher in the Rye, To Kill a Mockingbird, certainly something that a lot of people have read in junior high school or middle school or high school. So those books stay with people.
Yes.
But we're getting some data on not a lot of Americans reading. Do you think they just remember it because it's the last book they read in high school?
I hope not. Every once in a while I hear that, and I hope not. I hope Catcher in the Rye is a gateway book. You read that book and it allows you to read other books. But there is something pivotal about reading a book when you're a teen and those stories really stay with you. You haven't experienced the world, and reading is how you experience the world when you're 13.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's book nostalgia. I definitely, I mean, it was ironic that I got Atticus Finch as my character, because when I read To Kill a Mockingbird, I wanted Atticus Finch to be my dad.
Everyone did.
Yeah. Everybody had their Atticus Finch moment. Yes.
Well, we were talking about The Great American Read. Nikki Salcedo and Allison Law are going to stick around. It's a tough choice picking just the one book. Is being asked to pick your favorite book akin to being asked to choose your favorite child? On Second Thought, producer Don Smith thinks so, which is the subject of today's Gripe Bag.
I cannot live without books. Thus spake Thomas Jefferson. And so says the paperweight on my desk, a leather bookmark, and a lovely coffee mug. We're in the midst of a nationwide favorite American book contest, The Great American Read, organized by PBS. I can hear some of you asking, isn't the Bible everyone's favorite book? This contest is for novels in English. It is a splendid idea. I hate it. Voting for your favorite book? It's like deciding which breath you enjoyed most. 100 authors are represented, some like J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, are multi-volume. Some, like John Kennedy Toole's A Confederacy of Dunces, are one-shot wonders. Mark Twain and Charles Dickens, as expected, are here. So is Ayn Rand, for totally different reasons. George Orwell's 1984 has enjoyed a renaissance of its own, given recent political goings-on. Gone with the Wind and Catch-22 and The Catcher in the Rye are to be expected. As an English major, of course, I read some of The Pilgrim's Progress. Emphasis on some. But despite four tries, I never managed to make it all the way through War and Peace. And being a proud Southerner, I read To Kill a Mockingbird when it was not a bone of contention. I've read J.K. Rowling and John Irving, Ernest Hemingway and C.S. Lewis, Dan Brown and Michael Crichton, Kurt Vonnegut and Herman Melville, Agatha Christie and Jean M. Howell, Frank Herbert and Mario Puzo and Margaret Atwood. Many more dot the list whom I haven't read yet. Some I never will. And here's what I hate. These are just 100 or so fictional works I haven't read all of. What of biographies and histories and comedies and theatrical works and poetry and criticism and volumes of wonderful artwork and the several six-foot-tall stacks of books that stand in my house, in which the only room without books is the loo? I cannot live without books. Absolutely true. But I will die never having read unnumbered things I would have loved, never listened to music there was just not time to hear, never visited places I couldn't afford to go, never seen all the great and good movies. But I can darn well try. May even vote.
And we'll be back with more from The Great American Read. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last month, PBS launched The Great American Read. It's a national book club, a summer reading list, and a competition all rolled into one. Readers can vote for their favorite from a field of 100 books, and from that, elect one winner. Well, two of our favorite book people are here today, Allison Law and Nikki Salcedo in the studio. And we've been talking about what makes a great book, but what about the person holding that book? What makes a great reader? Is it a skill or is it an art? And what is the science behind reading? Terry Salinger joins us from our NPR studio in Washington, D.C. She's an institute fellow and chief scientist for reading research for the American Institutes of Research. Hello, Terry.
Good morning. Thank you for asking me.
Well, thank you for being here. Tracy Walker is also with us. She's a programming manager at the Forsyth Public Library here in Georgia. Hello, Tracy.
Hi, good morning.
So let's start with some numbers. 2018 Pew Research study found that 24% of Americans have not read an entire book in the past year. I'm wondering if that number surprises anybody. Nikki, yeah. Allison?
That surprises me.
Yeah.
Well, you want to see a book in everyone's hand.
I want to see a book in everyone's hand. One book a year, I think, is reasonable. I know we're busy and the world is changing, but I think everyone should be able to read one book a year.
Well, how about for you, Terry? How do people learn to read and make it a habit?
They see people reading around them. But this is the interesting thing. They don't have to see people reading books. They have to see people reading newspapers, reading stop signs, reading billboards, reading magazines, reading cookbooks. They have to see someone around them making sense out of what appear to be abstract little squiggles on a billboard or on a piece of paper. And when they really understand that those squiggles are representing speech that they're capable of, with which they're capable of communicating, then they begin to get insight into the cognitive process of learning to read. It's not quite that simple, but that's the top level.
That's the kind of terms that we can handle, I think, here today. But now, Terry, you're a part of what was called a reading intervention as part of your research. First of all, what does that mean?
That means that it is a program, either a program that's directly implemented with students, or it's a program that is implemented to enhance the capability of teachers, the capacity of teachers to teach reading, and specifically directed toward those students who are struggling to learn to read, whether they are really young children or adolescents or actually even adults. So it is something that is done to give value, added value to normal instructional practice.
So what were some of the findings?
The findings are unfortunately not as good as they should be, in that most of the studies that have been funded by the Department of Education have been relatively short duration, perhaps a year of professional development for teachers or a year of this special intense instruction for students. That many of us who research this area think is just not enough. There has to be some continuity. Because if to take adolescents, for example, a student has been struggling learning to read up until ninth grade and then suddenly finds himself or herself in a pullout class for 1 year that is teaching things that that student has had trouble with, some things are going to start to click, but some things aren't. And ideally, that student would continue to have the support that he or she needs to really build up those skills. And also, many of these interventions are relatively weak in the amount of actual reading that they ask students to do, the actual reading as we are today, I think, talking about reading, putting something very interesting, very engaging into the hands of these struggling readers where they just can't put it down because they want to keep reading to find out what's going to happen. Getting that spark, which is what your guests have been talking about, is part of the whole issue of providing an intervention to a struggling reader.
Okay, everyone here is nodding their heads, but I want to ask Tracy, because, you know, you're on the front lines of this as a librarian. That spark, somebody first has to come in order for you to do that. How do you encourage kids to read?
They do. That spark is so important. And one of the most important things I think we can do as people come into the library is really get a good idea of what their interests are. I think that's key in finding reading material that will hook them, that will help them to become lifelong readers. So, You know, in talking with people as they come in and they're looking for materials, finding those areas of interest. And Terry said something that was very interesting and I think so true, in that it doesn't have to be just books. If there are wonderful quality magazines out there, graphic novels have had a huge increase in popularity, and some wonderful writing in graphic novels and in comic books as well. So I think encouraging people to read in whatever manner most appeals to them is so important. The important thing is that they're reading.
Well, so Tracy, this is something that research has shown, that when parents push kids too hard to read books, they get turned off. And some suggest that you leave picture books around for your preteens. You're talking about graphic novels. Would you agree with that?
I very much so. Very much so.
How about games? I mean, that's one of the old saws, you know, that kids are watching games, spending too much time doing that. Those have narrative arcs. Those have it's again visual. Do you encourage that?
Definitely. I think, you know, and that goes back to everybody has a different way of learning. We all have different learning styles. And for some of us who are visual learners, and especially for kids who are visual learners, reading can be a very difficult thing. It's not always easy for someone to learn how to read and to continue reading throughout their lives. And so if you are a visual learner, I think having those things available to you are so important. And you mentioned games and how they have a narrative arc and things. I think there are wonderful lessons that you can learn from all of those things.
How about you, for Nikki and Allison here in our studio? When did it click for you, reading?
Well, I was just thinking, I was nodding my head too, thinking about visual learners, but for me, it was all about the sound of words. Before I knew how to read, I memorized the words on the page because I could hear my mother saying them to me. So I feel like we also have to reach out to children and other potential readers through music, because song lyrics are just our words and tell a story. And I think that's another way that we can get it to click in our heads.
How about for you, Nikki?
I like the idea of access. So kids who go into the library, kids who see people reading. My gateway was a box of books I think my cousin brought over, and it was Harlequin Romance and Louis L'Amour. And
the cowboy books.
The cowboy books. And children's literature had never appealed to me. And after, you know, reading romance novels and Westerns, and still to this day, I'm like, that's a happy book place for me. And, you know, those are my interests, which is like an adventure.
Nikki Salceda there. She's an author from Decatur. Allison Law is also with us. She's the host of the Literary Atlanta podcast. Tracy Walker is a program manager at the Forsyth Public Library. And Terry Salinger, a researcher in reading. What do you hear when you hear that, Terry? You know, are there particular books on the Great American Read List that are good literacy tools? And do graphic novels count? Should they count? Should we think differently about what is properly reading?
I have up on the screen in the booth the novels that are included on the list. So let me think about answering your first question, the first part of your question. What's showing is The Hunger Games. That might be a really good gateway book for some students. I reread Catcher in the Rye a couple of years ago, and I, of course, had loved it and loved it. It seemed a little dated, so I wouldn't recommend that. There are some, but again, as we've been saying, it really is matching the book to the student. In terms of graphic novels, I did a study, actually I'm wrapping up a study, where we interviewed a lot of seventh grade struggling readers. And one of the questions that we asked them was what they would like to read, what kinds of books they would like to read in the reading class they were attending. They gave us lots and lots and lots of suggestions. Romance novels definitely were included. The girls, the seventh grade girls who said that, were a little sheepish, but was okay. They wanted graphic novels. They read graphic novels outside of school. They actually went to the library and took them out. They found them very motivating, and they found them easier to read and more, they didn't use this term, but more sophisticated. The themes were more grown up. The themes were more in keeping with what adolescents are interested in. They also made a really good point about the Bluford books. I don't know if
I don't know them.
I'm not that.
The Bluford books is a widely published book. I can't remember the author right now. It's a series. They explain to us why these books are great. They are mostly urban high school and middle school students, many of whom are minority, most of whom are minority. But the students told us that what they liked about them was that it was kids their age who got themselves into trouble and figured out how to get themselves out of it. And I found that a really fascinating comment from kids who've been identified as struggling readers. They wanted to and actually were seeking out to read these books about kids like them, kids who'd been identified as struggling academically or coming from low-income families, or some of these kids were new immigrants to Greater Houston. So it's finding that book that will provide the motivation for kids to get over that hump, if you will, of I'm not a reader. And that I'm not a reader statement can come from kids who are struggling academically. It can also come from really competent readers who just have never liked to read.
The Bluford books, by the way, Eliza A. Commodoros is the author.
Thank you.
Terrific comment here from a listener. Sophia Wirth says, reading is definitely a skill. I have a learning disability and reading is difficult, very energy consuming. So reading for pleasure is literally an oxymoron for me. As a scientist, I need to gather and learn information. But for fun, I stick to audio visual stimulation like at NPR, which we really like to hear. But, you know, this is a thing. I think a lot of people feel judged, and I think parents especially feel judged if their kids are not reading the books they're supposed to be reading. Tracy, is that something, you know, part of your work? Is it kind of being a gateway for parents?
It is. And I think encouraging parents to encourage their kids to read what they're interested in is such an important thing. You know, you have those experiences where a child will show interest in a particular book and the parent will say, no, you can't get that one. It's not on the list, or it's not on the get this book instead. And those are heartbreaking moments sometimes, because really, the other book might have been something that would hook that child for a lifetime on reading, because it falls within their area of interest. So I think educating the parents about that is such an important thing of what we do in libraries.
Well, that's what Terry said. Seeing people read, this is a regular, a lot of people who are, especially new immigrants to the United States, don't necessarily have access to books in their own native language. And that's something that we're witnessing about libraries. They are becoming a kind of magnet for immigrant communities. Are you seeing that at the Forsyth?
Definitely, very much so. And something that we're very excited about up there is one of our branches, our Sharon Forks branch, just reopened after an extensive renovation. And one of the main goals we had was to add books in languages of some of the communities that are forming in our area, especially from different places in Asia. So now we offer books in, I believe, 5 of those languages. And we can't keep them on the shelves. We see them fly off the shelves, and we've had patrons express their gratitude at being able to have access to that reading material.
Now, Terry, for you, on this Great American Read list, I don't know if we got to that, the idea that there may be some books that are particularly good literacy tools. You're talking about starting kids really young. Maybe a couple of books good for beginning readers.
What would have been helpful is if we had hyper-contemporary work, works that were they're not just reflected our realities, but also that was written with our linguistic texture, right? I needed to hear my voice. I needed to hear the details of my language in the stories, and that wasn't a thing at the time.
Well, that beautiful, rich voice belongs to Jason Reynolds. He's talking there about having grown up in the 70s and 80s, African-American young man in Washington, D.C., not really seeing himself in the books that he read. But we are talking with a panel of people who are talking about readers. I really want to thank Terry Salinger, an Institute Fellow at the American Institutes for Research. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Tracy Walker, Programming Manager at the Forsyth Public Library. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, both Allison and Nikki are here for the hour. After the break, what do independent booksellers make of the Great American Read? We're going to find out on Second Thought, so stay with us.
What you know is true, don't have to tell you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you haven't checked out The Great American Read from PBS, do it now. You can go to gpb.org and you'll find a list of 100 books and a chance to vote for your favorite. There's also a quiz that's going to tell you which fictional character you most resemble. And we're not going to vouch for the science behind said quiz, so please, no hate mail if you perhaps find out that you're a stone-cold killer like Michael Corleone. Which would be me. Guiding us through this hour have been Allison Law and Nikki Salcedo, familiar names to our regular listeners. Allison hosts the Atlanta Literary Podcast. Nikki is a writer based in Decatur. And we've talked about writing and the art and science of reading a little bit, but what about what we're calling the middlemen, the booksellers? What do they think of The Great American Read, and what do their customers think? Independent bookstore owner Gazemde Ajumo. I'm so sorry. I'm going to do that all again. Independent bookstore writer, owner, Kazemde Ajumo is from the Black Dot Store, and he's joining us in the studio. Hello, Kazemde.
Hi, how are you?
Very fine to see you. This is just like a beautiful book fest of a day. So Shane Gottwals is also in our Macon studio. He owns Gottwals Books, that's in Macon, and several other places around the state. Hello, Shane.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. I mean, independent bookstores, as we know, gone through a hard time, beginning in the late 90s with the big box stores and then Amazon. Now, I think, making a real comeback. Shane, who are your customers?
Honestly, we talk about this. We have two target markets. One is the retirees who seem to have some time on their hands to buy some books. And between gardening and cooking, they read their novels. And the others are really mostly women in their 30s and 40s that have young children, which is super encouraging to see because they are bringing their kids in and making reading and bookstores and libraries a part of life. So those are kind of our two key demographics. But we certainly attract everyone from old to young.
How about you, Kazemde, over at Black Dot?
Most of my customers are 40 and under, young African-American men and women with children. So I find that to be probably my largest demographic.
Do you find people coming in and asking for books on the Great American Read list?
No.
How about for you, Shane?
We sell, going through this list, I mean, we sell so many of these, I can't even count them. And we create displays around this, and I was pretty excited about most of these entries on the list.
So what are some of the surprises for you in the Great American Read list?
There's a few. I have an English degree and spent some time at Oxford University just studying. I'm kind of a purist for the literary canon. And so, you know, not seeing the Iliad and the Odyssey, it was a little surprising. There are some that maybe I would have swapped out for a different, you know, Hemingway is on here, but I might have picked Farewell to Arms instead of Sun Also Rises, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me, too.
Yeah, listen.
Yeah.
Well, okay, Kazemde, the literary canon, you know, those usually are big words cast in stone, and you have a bookstore that caters to a different audience.
Yes.
What does the literary canon mean to you?
Well, to me, it from an African-American perspective, it's really highlighting some of the great African-American authors and scholars and historians that really kind of educate people that are interested in subject matters, whether it's spirituality, history, education. So lifting up those authors that are bringing that to the table is kind of what we look for at the Black Dot.
Well, we know that in the publishing industry, I want to quote some figures from that, but also in, you know, looking at this list, James Baldwin in the top 20, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who is a Nigerian-born author, and that is one thing on this list. All of the books had to have been published in English. They didn't actually have to be from an American author. But for you, what do you use as a starting point for your inventory? Is it your own taste? Is it things that people are asking for?
It started with my own taste, books that I've read over the last 20 years, and then the list kind of grew by customers obviously asking for certain books and meeting certain scholars that have suggested other books for me.
Well, this is a reflection of books that are beloved, this Great American Read List, and that have sold well. You and Shane are in the front row seat to the business, and what gets attention from publishers? How does that affect what sells? Shane, maybe that's a good question for you.
Yeah, I mean, because they're the one obviously driving everything that's being printed and what would then be available for us through these publishers to actually buy and stick in our stores. But there's also a huge rise in independent publishing. It's just such a big chunk of the market now, and it's growing every day, it feels like. And so it really provides a very diverse range. We do a lot of used and new books, and so we have a trade-in program. So we end up getting a pretty good mix overall. But with those independent publishers, those independent authors, distribution sources, and just through our own channels, we'll make sure that there's always C.S. Lewis in there. There's always the classics. You know, so when we have holes, gaps, we feel like it's just not representing the full a scope of literature that we feel like our store should, we'll supplement from all those various channels.
I'm looking from at a study, Roxane Gay, who's an author. She worked with a number of researchers and looked at the books reviewed by the New York Times in 2011, you know, the biggest reviewer. Of the 742 books reviewed across all genres, 655 written by Caucasian authors, one transgender, 437 men, 217 women, lots of numbers here, while 31 were the work of African or African-American writers, nine Hispanic authors, very few Asian authors. You know, Allison, this is something you watch as a reviewer in the business. Books that get reviewed, that get pushed, that get sold, do they come from a diverse body of authors?
No. I mean, it's getting better, certainly, but I think we need to look at this list from a historical perspective and see that were it not for Alice Walker, who appears on the list with her book, The Color Purple, we would not have Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, because Alice Walker recovered that author for us. So I think we need to do a better job of taking a look at those numbers. And then there also is the Vita count, where you're looking at the number of writers, of women of color, people of color, different backgrounds. And while the two most popular stories in The New Yorker in the last year were written by women, they still are overrepresented in terms of having more male authors. So we just have to keep doing a better job.
And Kazembe, this puts you kind of in an uphill battle, doesn't it, to find books by African-American authors?
I don't know if it necessarily puts me in an uphill battle. I think that I have a niche market. And to use the movie Black Panther as an example, there's a reason why that sold well. It was about culture. It was historical. And finding books that fall within that same genre, if you will, is what's selling to African-Americans.
Well, Shane just mentioned self-published books, e-books. You know, this is coming out by authors. But this is a way for new voices to come out. But this is also considered your competition, isn't it, an ebook?
It's not competition for me. I can literally say probably less than 2% of the people that have walked in my door have asked about ebooks. People like to feel and smell the paper and to write their notes and to go back and look at it 6 months or a year or 2 years from now and read it again and glean something different from the first time they read it. So that's not a problem. I don't even think about ebooks, actually.
Do they come in actually? Shane, pick that up?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's it felt like it was going to be a much bigger deal a few years back, maybe I guess 2010 or so. You talked to Orrin Tyker with the ABA or Wanda Jewell with SIBA, the Sunday Independent Booksellers Association. They'll both tell you that ebook sales in general are just dropping every year, year over year. I think folks are just, and we see it a lot. We see the grandmother that comes in and says, my son bought me a Kindle and I used it once and I hate it. You know, give me a book any day of the week. You know, the printed page, I need that smell. I need that tactile, approach to this reading thing. So I'm with you. It really doesn't affect what we're doing right now.
That's Shane Gottwals, independent bookstore owner, Gottwals Books in Macon and other places about the state. Kazemde Ajumo, the independent bookstore owner also. He is the Black Dot Store here in Atlanta. Allison Laws with us from the Literary Atlanta podcast. And Nikki Salcedo, a Decatur-based author. And Nikki and Allison, I'm going to put you both on the spot. Where do you buy your books?
Where Uh-oh. Don't I buy my books? I'm just, I wrote down the Black Dot because that's one I haven't been to yet. So, you know, watch out. I'll be back.
But do you ever buy books online?
Sure. Yes.
Well, I think most people do.
I resist buying books online in rare circumstances when I speak to booksellers and they cannot get a book for me. I will.
Yeah.
And my family jokes with me. They're like, whenever you walk into a bookstore, you're like Norm from Cheers, where they're like, Nikki, because I know I'm going to, you know. And many of the bookstores around Atlanta, East Atlanta, they know me by name. And I go into independent booksellers every week.
So, Shane, it sounds like you're running the gamut. Kazemde, you're much more specialized. So do people know what they want when they walk into your store, or are they looking for advice?
Actually, I would say 65% of the people, and they being young, don't know. They're searching for information. So I have to play guide, and that's a good thing.
Well, we heard earlier from Jason Reynolds. He's a YA author. His books are bestsellers. Do you have a lot of, you said, under 40 customers, but in that YA range, this has been a huge genre in the past 10, 15 years. Is that working for you?
No. Children books and books that cater to, books that are catering to children, educational, is what most of the parents are looking for. So children books are probably my bestseller. And then historical books about African and African-American culture. So those are my two driving categories.
How about you, Shane? We've been talking a lot about younger people reading. Is YA fiction flourishing among your customers?
It is. Yeah. Well, I'd say, as far as gross numbers, gross volume, probably around 30% of our total sales is for teen and younger ages. And I tell all of our new hires, I tell them, you know, this is not a retail position. Kind of speaking back to your last question, it's not a retail position. It's a service position. So even though we're selling things as a bookseller, it's such a different experience. I mean, nothing against folks who own yogurt shops, but you know what they do in a yogurt shop is not what a bookseller does. You know, we've got to really curate the selection, and yeah, we get those bright blue-eyed 6-year-old girls who want to come in and say, hey, I want a funny story about a little girl, you know, with some mischief going on in her life, and we'll point them to Junie B. Jones or whoever else. It might be. And that's a big part of our responsibility, not just standing behind the checkout and taking money.
I have a lot of therapists at bookstores. Librarians and booksellers are my therapists.
Well, we're talking about getting kids reading, getting kids into stores, but indie bookstores are especially a place where adults gather. Let me ask each, you know, Kazemde and Shane, have you noticed your stores functioning as more than a store, as a kind of meeting place for like-minded people?
Well, what's interesting with my story is I started my bookstore inside of a vegan restaurant. I had a little 12x9 space.
Uh-huh.
And I probably sold at that time 100, 115 books on average a month. 90% of the people that came in there did not come in there to buy a book. They came in there to eat. And by virtue of books being there, they gravitated towards them. When I moved into my own space, I created a cultural center where people can come in and have coffee or conversate, Wi-Fi, and by virtue of creating events and things of that nature, people buy books. So it's a meeting place.
How about dating? I mean, this seems like a lot of bookstores have become a place where people might meet somebody of like mind they might want to spend more time with.
I think
I have a friend who's had well, actually, I have a couple of bookstore friends who've had folks actually get married in their bookshop. And so that is a common thing. And we encourage our employees. You kind of have to create a culture. You have to make it a community center. You know, it's, again, going back to the yogurt shop, we franchise nationwide. So we have people who are opening stores all over the country. And we when we teach them and train them how to do this, we say, listen, you know, you're going to be a place that you can do a whole lot out of. You can do the book clubs. You can do the kids' events. For the you know, for summer reading programs, things like that, and you know, you can bring people in and let's and discuss things and talk about books and ideas, and we let our employees stand around and talk about those ideas with them. They better keep checking folks out and keeping the lines moving, but they're encouraged to have those conversations.
So, what is the allure of a bookstore for you? I'm going to ask Nikki and Allison. You mentioned, you know, they greet you when you come in, Nikki. But what does that mean to have that hand-sold experience?
It means a lot. I've had several occasions where I've walked into a bookstore and one of the booksellers says, "You cannot leave without buying this book." And to me, it's not something that happens every time. I trust a bookseller. It's a valued relationship. And when I walk in, I am walking into another world. And that's why I continue to go into bookstores.
Yeah, for me, my friend Amy and I have talked about we're going to patent one of those, you know, little Christmas tree air fresheners, except it's going to be a book. And it'll have that bookstore smell that we can put in our car hanging from the rearview mirror. There's just something about it. I remember when I first moved away from home and moved away to Lexington, Kentucky, there's a wonderful independent bookstore there called Joseph Beth. And I can still smell the mixture of the lavender from the product section and the pesto from the cafe. And I felt like, even though I didn't know a soul there, that I was surrounded by people who had something in common with me.
Okay, so I'm not going to ask the question that Don Smith hates so much, which is your favorite book of this list, but ask you, what are you going to read this summer? Mm-hmm. What's on your beach blanket book list or air-conditioned inside book list?
I am reading a book by Chokwe Lumumba, about Chokwe Lumumba, which was the first African-American mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, called The Black Scholar.
Wow. Next.
I'm reading some John Maxwell. I like to go about 80% sort of practical, and then I come up for air with a novel every once in a while. But John Maxwell, leadership and business books, and then also a C.S. Lewis biography right now.
How about for you, Nikki? She's looking really pensive right now. She's going through the 7 books on her nightstand, probably visually.
Well, I'm probably going to reread Where the Red Fern Grows. And I think that's a good thing about the list, which is bringing back some books that I had loved at a previous point in my life. So I have it on my shelf. I'll open it up again this summer.
I hope you have some Kleenex on the shelf as well.
Oh, yes.
I remember that being a real tearjerker.
Yes.
Yeah, I will tell you what's top of mind because I'm going to be talking to the author later for the podcast, but it's Empress by an Emory historian. She is a feminist historian, and Empress is about Nur Jahan, which was one of the first co-sovereigns of Mughal India in the 1600s.
Okay, before we go, I just have to add a comment from Marilyn Hall, a listener. I'm embarrassed to say I've never read Gone with the Wind or seen the movie. You're not alone,
not alone,
our
Marilyn.
Friend Marilyn. So many books to read, so little time. I want to thank our panelists here, Kazemde Ajumo from the Black Dot Bookstore. Hello, and thank you.
Thank you again.
Shane Gottwells from Macon at Gottwells Books.
It was awesome. Thanks.
Allison Law and Nikki Salcedo right here in the studio with me. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Virginia Prescott. Such a very long time, I finally